It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacy's got the day off, but Wendy Nather's sitting in for Stacy from Duo Security. Also, Aunt Pruitt stops by and Jeff Jarvis. We will talk, of course, about Facebook. Jeff and I are going to get in a big fight over this one, I can tell. And Google and a whole lot more. I want you to stay tuned. This is a fun one. This Week in Google's next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 451, recorded Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. Boss Man 69. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about so much more than Google. It's really poorly named. Facebook, of course, is going to be a big topic today and almost every day, every week this year. But also Twitter and whatever else we want to talk about. Stacy's got the day off. That's good news. It means we have room for other people, although we will miss Stacy. Jeff Jarvis is here. It's great to have you, Jeff,
from
the City University of New York, where he teaches journalism. BuzzMachine.com is his blog. So many books, Public Parts, What Would Google Do, et cetera, et cetera. Aunt Pruitt is also with us. Aunt is a contributor at Tech Republic. He's been on Twit before. I don't think he's ever been on Twig before, so it's great to have you, Aunt.
Thank you for having me. Yes, sir. This is my first time on Twig.
A drone operator par excellence who has told me I should never again get a drone. He's also a great photographer.
Yeah, not for you.
great photographer and a Clemson fan. And always a pleasure to have Aunt on. And for the first time on the show also, thrilled to have her, Wendy Nather. She is a CISO, a Chief Information Security Officer, and in fact runs the advisory CISOs group at Duo Security, which is a great security firm. Well, welcome, Wendy. Great to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Wendy was on our panel, Stacy and my panel at South by Southwest last month. And I met her, and I said, we got to get her on. In fact, we're slowly getting everybody on. I met in Austin bit by bit because I had such a good time.
Despite the queso jokes. I'm really sorry about the queso jokes.
Aha!
Wendy, it's a test. Have you had Taco Bell queso? I mean, Chipotle queso?
The Chipotle queso? No, I haven't dared try it.
No, she lives in Austin,
for your protection.
Jeff.
Don't do it, Wendy.
Do they even bother having a Chipotle in Austin? Now they do, which is weird, but I don't.
We do right across from the Duo building, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
We've got one. Yeah.
So you had an opportunity, but you've been wiser than that. Wisely declined.
Yep, it's not your concern anymore.
So. Oh. She's going to do it again with those puns. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, you just got off a conference call that Facebook had with reporters. Well, there's a few pieces of news about Facebook we might as well mention. Mark Zuckerberg will be testifying in front of Congress a week from Thursday, April 11th. Next Wednesday.
Oh, it's Wednesday. Sorry.
Yeah, he's going to testify before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. That'll be very interesting. Preparatory to that, Facebook's been getting very active talking. Oh, you know, before I even bring up Facebook, I forgot. We really probably should mention.
Yes, we should.
Our thoughts and prayers and hearts and mind go out to our friends at YouTube in San Bruno. Of course, there was a shooting yesterday. The good news, it looks like nobody except the shooter died in that shooting. So that's relatively good news.
It's so unnerving to see someone you know. I saw Vadim Larusek tweeting that he was holed up in a closet in a room because there was an active shooter. And you see that, and it brings it all the more home.
The weird thing about Vadim is her account was hacked. And that, his account was hacked. Some of his tweets were, in fact, fake. During the event, but I think the closet one was real. Mix of tweets on his account, but you know him. Yeah, well, that was a very strange thing. Actually, one of the stories about all of this is how instantly Russian trolls, bots, bad actors in general jump into the fray to create a mass of phony news, phony stories, phony tweets. It's they're like predators now, just leaping into the action.
So that's, it's sickening.
It's and depressing.
It makes you wonder, what can Twitter do about that? Because that's just going to continue to happen.
Yeah, I mean, his account was hijacked while he was still near the scene of the attack. It was 20 minutes after LaRussek reported himself safe. One of the tweets leaked to a picture of a popular YouTuber saying, please help me find my friend. I lost him in the shooting. That's just, I mean, this is these. There's something wrong with these people.
Yes.
Twitter immediately jumped on it and removed the hoax tweets. And then, even though more hoax tweets came in, eventually, I think, cleared it up. So somebody was sitting at Twitter watching with a finger on the button. Anyway, our thoughts are with
yeah, and all it's all the worse that it's someone who was disgruntled with YouTube who decided to go after YouTube, and when everyone is public, anyone can become a target of this kind of public rage and sickness.
You know, I was actually a little disheartened, and maybe it's inaccurate, but I'd heard that there wasn't much security at YouTube. She got in through a public parking garage. She didn't need a badge or anything. And
I find that hard to believe. I mean, I haven't been to YouTube's offices in years, but at Google, by God, you cannot tailgate. You are checked.
Good. Any media company these days has security. Our doors are locked. We have an armed guard at the door, an armed guard, a former Marine at the door. He's got both lethal and non-lethal ways of stopping people and will. It's really important. In fact, because of this, Mo told me he's going to be doing some exercises on, what do you call it?
Active shooter.
Active shooter exercises.
Yeah, I've got, that's very harrowing. I've gone through that at my school and it really is, disturbing.
It's a shame that we have to do this, that we live in this world. It's so sad. This isn't even a gun control conversation. She owned the gun. It was a handgun. It wasn't, you know, it's just sad. It makes me so sad. Anyway,
it's the fact that someone thinks it's okay to go in and cause serious harm on another human being.
She was obviously disturbed. I mean, she was a vegan, yes. Right? She had a vegan. She hated cruelty to animals, but she'd go shoot humans. Obviously, this is a disturbed person. It's not.
And, yeah, his father had reported this to police. The police had talked to her. But the laws are such, too, that until you've done something, you know, that's the terrible paradox of our harm laws. You can't stop them until they've done something, then it's too late.
We've had, we have a fan who's unfortunately has some mental illness issues who has threatened me many times. And I've talked to police about it. They know about it. It's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Nothing you can
do. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. Anyway, there's nothing much to say except how sad that is. And
yes,
I don't know what you do. It's just this is the way it is in the world today. Now on to Facebook. Among other things, we learned today that Facebook has just told maybe it was on this call. I bet it was told reporters that it wasn't 50 million people. Cambridge Analytica had information on it was 87 million.
It was before the call, but what Zuckerberg did say on this call was that the 50 million figure never came from Facebook.
Ah.
That they wanted to, and you know, they should have said, we're not sure about that number, but they did the research and said that today looked at the maximum number of accounts that could, you know, one person plays the game, all the people, this is back in 2014, all the people who were friends with that person, their public data could have been scraped at the time. What was the maximum number of friends each user of that game had at the time? And that leads to the 87 million. And he said that's the maximum they believe. That's the first number they came out with. He was also asked about, again, this goes back to 2014. They were told that the data had been deleted. They got rid of the app and so on at the time. But more learned since.
April 9th, Monday, Facebook is going to notify people who were exposed to this.
And, and let's be clear here. This was your public data. So a researcher was able to get access to through the API, you know, easily, but nothing you probably couldn't have done through search, to the public data that you had in your account at the time.
All of your, for instance, all of your likes are public.
Your data. Likes, right.
And Cambridge Analytica was particularly interested in likes because it turns out with enough likes on any individual, you can predict fairly accurately a lot of things about that individual, including their mental state, their political views, their race, their religion, their sex, on and on.
And I worked with media companies at the time that were eagerly doing the exact same thing.
Sure. And don't you think people still are?
Well, you can. That's what I wanted to ask. Where do you draw the line? Because it seems like every online business or, heck, just broadcasting company or whatever, they have to do some type of data analytics, and they're going to go out and scrape whatever they can scrape.
You're right.
I mean, heck, even the Twit Network does an annual survey.
Well, that's voluntary. That's I should point out. We go to you and say, take it if you want. But advertisers want that information. But that's kind of the hard rock and hard place that a lot of media companies are in between radio and TV. They don't know that much about their viewers. And that's one of the reasons. What is it? 80% of advertising is now snarfed up by Google and Facebook.
No, I don't think it's 80% of advertising.
A large number. No.
It's that much growth in advertising goes there because they can offer that. I mean, and you're right. If you go back when I worked in the old ancient days of magazines and worked at Time Inc., they had data from you in places like Axiom, big data warehouses, where they had tons of behavioral data about you as an individual with your name and your address and your phone number and your credit card number going way back. In some ways, there's actually less data available through the social platforms when it comes to that kind of PII and behavior.
Facebook
now,
and
there's
Google.
More analytical ability to now say, what are these likes and what do your habits say about you? You know, in the old days, you drove a Volvo, you were liberal. You know,
according to Pivotal, Facebook and Google account for 73% of all digital advertising in the U.S.
Digital. Big difference.
Yeah. But a lot, I would be willing to venture that a lot of broadcast advertising is moving digital.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The other thing that Zuckerberg said today was, there was a report yesterday that he had told Reuters that he would not be extending Europe's GDPR privacy regulations to the world.
That's a little disappointing.
And he said today, he said that was see, you're already heading down the fake news path there, Leo. You're already heading down the presumptions. Zuckerberg said today that that was not true. What he told the reporter was that, yes, they'd be extending the standards of GDPR globally. He said they're going to be different in some countries in how it's done because there's different laws and stuff. But he said that they would be setting the standards of GDPR globally.
Well, that's very good.
He told that to the Reuters reporter.
So the reporter just misreported it.
That's what Facebook is saying.
Okay. You'll forgive me if I don't fully trust everything that comes out of Mark's mouth. I know he's a nice guy. I'm sure he is.
Why. The other weird moments were when, and I listened into the whole call. That's why we're delayed starting.
No, I'm glad. Live. I'm glad you did. Yeah. This is.
And so then I thought awkward moment. The FT reporter asks, well, has your board of directors discussed whether you're the right person to lead the company? Beat, pause. Zuckerberg said, not to my knowledge.
That is another
NPR reporter. Yeah. Basically asked the same thing again. They're going after, they're trying to fuel this narrative of firing Zuck. Then a BuzzFeed reporter.
Did Zuck act pause as if he had not heard that? Like,
no, it's kind of shocking to, somebody's asking you that to your face. Does your board think you should be fired? You know, Leo, does Lisa think you should be fired?
Probably.
Well, there's a little beat there.
almost certainly at times.
Probably. certainly from loading the dishwasher, yeah.
Does Mark sit in on all the board meetings? Is he?
Oh, sure. I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, he's on the board, but I mean, wonder.
Yeah, no. Yeah, so except executive session.
I wonder if the board might say, Mark, could you leave the room? We'd like to have a private conversation about your future.
Every board meeting I've ever been a part of, there is always executive session built in.
Yes.
And you don't sit in on a compensation committee here.
Exactly. It's an executive session. Yeah.
That's
and he's not in on those. And yeah, and they don't have to say what they're going to talk about. It's normal.
No.
So he doesn't know.
The other thing that was interesting was a BuzzFeed's reporter. And BuzzFeed, you know, depended greatly on Facebook and now tends to be a little bit bitter because of the public content shift. And so the BuzzFeed reporter said, this is wonderful naivete of the journalist. Well, couldn't you, everything be better if you just made less money?
Oh, my God. Yeah, everything would be better if we all made less much. He should, Mark should just say, wouldn't it be better if you made less money?
Come on.
You know, Tristan Harris has been out there attacking Facebook along with Roger McNamee. I was at sessions where Tristan goes further and says, get rid of all advertising. That's a solution.
How is that?
Well, exactly. And then I did a post last week, and I started it all. At the end of the post, I'm very demanding of Facebook in a lot of ways. But at the beginning, I took on Matthew Iglesias, who's a very good political commentator at Vox. But I took him on. He was just saying, he was telling Zuckerberg to shut down Facebook. Come on, people. Come on. I talk about. No. And why should it? Even Siva Vaidyanathan, who's wonderful and who's doing a critical book on Facebook coming out soon, you know, he answers and says, when you people say delete Facebook, you're leaving. That's a position of privilege to say. There are people who depend upon it.
Oh, that's BS. I don't buy that.
You stay and fix. No, there are people in countries. If you go to India, people depend upon Facebook. You go to some countries. And what he's saying is don't delete it. Fix it. Stay under pressure.
I deleted it. I'm sorry. So equating Facebook with privilege is BS. Facebook is, I mean, maybe it's a luxury. It's a thing. It's a luxury. Need Twitter. You don't need Facebook for crying out loud. I don't buy that. That's ridiculous. Fine.
Let's see. Hold on. The link is in there to Siva's post.
I can't claim to have a deep understanding of why Facebook might be critical to life in India, but I find that hard to believe.
Hold on here. Let me go to Siva.
I think about the use case of Facebook with like my family back home. That's all they use. There's no phone calls. There's always Facebook Messenger or Facebook post or what have you to keep in touch with all of the family that's abroad that, you know, that actually got out of town.
So you're saying if you were to delete Facebook, you would just be disconnecting from them?
I have gotten rid of Facebook and deleted it. I did so back in January. And yeah, I don't hear from anybody in my family except for my mother.
That's too bad.
I mean, it is what it is. Facebook has turned into the telephone.
Strikes me that that's all the more reason to leave Facebook, but okay.
Yeah.
And not because you want to disconnect from family, but because we don't want to have a world in which Facebook is a necessity.
So Siva wrote this in the New York Times, and I quote, people in those countries, which is to say, India, Egypt, Indonesia, Philippines, Brazil, Mexico. People in those countries are getting value out of Facebook. In some places, it's one of the few reliable ways to keep in touch. In much of the developing world, Facebook is also the only news source that matters. This should horrify us, but it's not a problem that will be solved by indignant Americans leaving the service.
Why?
Moreover, quitting Facebook lets Google and Twitter off the hook. It lets AT&T and Comcast and its peers off the hook. The dangers of extremist propaganda and hate speech are just as grave on YouTube, which is owned by Google.
Okay, true.
It's a very good
option. Are you saying I can't quit Facebook because unless I quit everybody else? No.
That's ridiculous. He's saying you rich white American says, well, I did my part. I quit Facebook for the world.
Now, I agree. I'm not going to say Facebook. I did my part or it's done or I've done everything I can do for privacy. No. But at the same time, you cannot give me any argument that says I have to be part of that piece of crap.
You don't have to be part of it, but to act like you've solved the problem by doing that.
No, I'm not saying that. And that's why we're still talking about it. But no, absolutely not. But I don't think I'm going to stay on Facebook to save it from within. That's an illusion as well.
But he's not telling you to stay on Facebook. He's telling you that to stand up, as people have been doing in their Twitter campaign and trumpeting, we quit Facebook is... No, glib.
I just find it creepy, and I don't want anything to do with it. And there's no justification. You can stay. I'm not saying you should leave, but I don't want to have anything. I don't want to go anywhere near it. And I hear about Facebook makes me glad I'm not there anymore.
I quote his end. So go ahead and quit Facebook if it makes you feel calmer or more productive. Please realize, though, that you might be offloading problems onto those who may have less opportunity to protect privacy and dignity and are more vulnerable to threats to democracy. If the people who care the most about privacy, accountability, and civil discourse evacuate Facebook in disgust, the entire platform becomes less informed and diverse. Deactivation is the opposite of activism, says Siva.
Couldn't disagree.
And Siva is no friend of Facebook.
I love Siva a lot, but I couldn't disagree more.
Mr. Jarvis, now, just listening to that, and I think about the gazillion conversations that I've tried to have with people that were in my circles, if you will, on Facebook about privacy and about, you know, just being careful with what's posted and what's being liked and so forth. And about 10% gave a crap. Nobody cares outside of, you know, you try to inform people and they don't care. What they care most about is the, this is me right now, and this is the braggadocious, be happy for me, or this is the woe is me, y'all need to send out good vibes from me. That's all Facebook is. There, when you want to try to share legitimate quality information, personally, I've gotten nothing from it. Nothing. Nobody gave a crap.
I just don't want to add any value to Facebook by being a member of Facebook. And I think that that's... No,
seriously. See, I do think that's glib. I think that again, what I've said on the show before is I think that you're doing what Matthew Iglesias did and you're declaring it broken. And for most people, it is not. That's right. The media narrative that drives me kind of crazy here. And when you do that to Facebook, by the way, I'm going to contend that you're doing it to the internet, because what you're opening the door to is regulation that I believe is going to be highly damaging to the internet as a whole.
Quite the contrary. I think the existence of Facebook is damaging to the internet, that Facebook is eating the internet alive, that Facebook would like to be the internet, especially in developing nations where internet.org is really facebook.com, and Facebook should be shut down, frankly. I think Facebook should be shut down.
Oh, come on, Leo. I absolutely believe that.
I'm not going to say shut it down.
Thank you, Angie.
No, I think
you take over now, Ant.
I think it should be shut down. I think it's a blight on the face of the internet.
See, Ant, we've been waiting for Stacey. Should have a device that comes out of her screen with a little a fist on it and pops Leo when he goes overboard. Right? You should have that. You're in Stacey's seat.
I think I owe an apology to Wendy because she's been dragged into this show and she's going, "What the hell did I agree to be part
of?" Sorry.
This is just how we are, Wendy. Don't mind us. It's just we just like to bicker. All right. There's the two polar points of view. I here's another story. Facebook apparently scans your Facebook Messenger messages for offensive content and then blocks them. Did you know that if you're using Facebook Messenger, that Facebook's reading every message you send and looking for offensive content? Facebook has decided
both sides. People are trying to say Facebook should be cleaning up the world. When Facebook cleans up the world, I don't like that either. But
don't people have the presumption that their messages are private? I mean, if you're a bad guy, you're not using Facebook anyway. You're using Signal.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? If you're a bad guy using Facebook, you probably, the word should go forth.
Right. You're not very good at
your job. somebody's saying I sound like a temperance evangelist. Facebook is demon rum.
You tell them, chat room. Who said that in the chat room?
Punter Joe,
right you are. Yes, this is moral panic.
No, I so disagree with you, Jeff, as you know. And the more we learn about Facebook, the more evil it appears to be. And I just...
He quotes researcher Ashley Crossman defining moral panic as, quote, a widespread fear, most often an irrational one, that someone or something is a threat to the values, safety, and interests of a community or society at large.
Wait a minute.
Typically, a moral panic is perpetuated by news media.
Do you think I'm ill-informed? Do you think I'm ill-informed on Facebook?
I think
I'm very, very well informed on Facebook. Your support.
You think
for
every
Facebook.
One of the 2 billion people who are on Facebook that they are just thrust into the faces of Nazis every day?
I think they don't know what they're giving up to Facebook.
How elitist. How elitist?
No, it's not elitist. Facebook hides that. Facebook actively hides that. Did they tell you they were scanning your messages? They were collecting your Android call history? Word of warning, we're keeping track of all the phone calls you make, how long they last, and who you're calling. Did they tell people that? Absolutely not. Facebook actively dissembles. When they get caught, they apologize, and then they go right ahead and do it.
And in my post, I argue that they need to do a very harsh and outside moral audit of the company. I don't disagree.
That's moral panic. How dare you? How dare you criticize them?
In this way, says Crossman, moral panic can foster increased social control. That's what I fear.
Here's the social control.
Comic books are ruining youth.
I'm not suggesting that Facebook be banned. I would like to see it regulated, but I don't have
any. You said shut it down, Leo.
No, I didn't say shut it down. I said it should be shut down, but I didn't say you.
Well,
I would be offended if. But no, government doesn't shut down private industry unless they break laws.
Well, this president, who knows? He's going after Amazon.
Yeah, he's never going after Facebook. I can pretty much guarantee that. He's looking forward to the year 2020. He's got his Facebook team already put together, I'm sure. Don't you think Jared's already thinking about how are we going to use Facebook in 2018? Don't you think?
Next?
Don't you think? Not that they should be stopped, but I just.
I'm sorry. Let me just finish this post. I'll be right with you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, right. Wendy.
I think we agreed to leave Wendy out of this.
Leave me out of this.
Climate.
I hate it when mommy and daddy fight.
I don't want the audience to think we were purposely. I think Wendy's the sane one.
Yes.
Who opted out of this beginning, and we can move on to other things.
That's why she's here. Let's see. Should we talk about Google?
Sure. Changes at Google.
Letters. Yes. Well, for one thing. Now, here's the question. Did Gianandrea get hired away by Apple and then Google said, oh, yeah, he's not here anymore? Or did he leave and then go to Apple? What's the timeline?
Well, the story was, so Ben Gomes, who I like, who got elevated as the head of search and what's his name? Jeff Dean takes over AI. That got announced, and they said that their former boss was going to stay at the company. So if he knew he was leaving, you'd think that they wouldn't have announced it that way.
So he was the AI genius, right, at Google.
I think Apple pounced is what that looks like to me.
Apple saw an opportunity.
We'll cover whatever separation agreement stuff. We'll pay for that. We're going to steal their AI guy.
So
there was some obviously political fight about AI within the company. I don't have any idea what it was. It's fascinating.
Right. There's always something else going on that the media is not going to know for sure.
Yeah. I mean,
there's always some type of water cooler talk that we're not going to get.
Gianandrea was the founder of something called MetaWeb, which Google bought in 2010. And that's how he joined Google. MetaWeb. Helped websites link information based on connections between people, places, and things instead of words. Does anybody remember MetaWeb? I don't even.
No, I don't either.
It must have been doing something kind of interesting. So the idea was it was more natural language search queries.
Developed Freebase.
Okay. Freebase was.
An open shared database of the world's knowledge.
Right. It was an open database.
Danny Hillis.
Oh, Danny Hillis. All right. Well, there's another legendary name in technology. So
acquired in 2010, shut down Freebase 2016. God bless Wikipedia.
Mm. So Gianandrea was then search at Google, right? As well as AI. He is now going to run Apple's machine learning and AI strategy, one of 16 executives who report directly to Tim Cook. Time said the hire is a victory for Apple. Apple's been behind, of course, with AI and Siri.
They don't have as much data.
You know, I think Apple would say that's not our problem. That's not the problem. But it's, I mean, sure, on the outside, it looks like, you know, Google, which knows everything, is easily able to make a smart assistant because it's collecting all these signals, has all this training material. Apple says we don't collect all that stuff. But at the same time, Apple wants Siri to be as good as Google Assistant. So that's apparently, you know, Gianandrea was running Google Brain for a while, which is their primary AI lab. So, I think you could say that Apple had a score. They sure moved fast. I wonder. Boy, yeah. I wonder.
How hard is it to send a text message of a couple dollar signs?
A lot of dollar signs, though, because he must have had deferred income and all kinds of things.
It strikes me that that kind of hire takes a long time.
Yeah, there had to be some serious negotiations.
They had to be talking. I'm thinking they were talking before this.
But then why would they have announced? But then he played a game. He acted like he was going to stay there, and then the next day he says, never mind. Is that what's
this happens every day, though. This happens everywhere besides these huge companies. This happens at middle America, you know. Yeah. Somebody's out there busting their hump for the last 5-6 years and get an itch to you know, put their foot in the water somewhere else. They're not going to just up and leave. They're going to see what's available to them. They'll talk to the headhunters in the background and just, you know, play the role. It happens.
I would, though, if you're Apple, you don't want to hire this guy just because – he's, you throw a lot of money at him doesn't mean he's going to be able to turn around Siri. You want him to come to Apple because he thinks he can turn around Siri, because he has some ideas about what Apple needs to do to be competitive with Google. He's also, remember, going to be highly constrained in what he can do, because I've got to think Google has all sorts of restrictions on the, just look at the Uber Waymo suit on the kinds with Lewandowski went from Google to Uber.
Right.
All sorts of restrictions on what he can, what technologies he can bring to Apple, what he could talk about at Apple. He's not going to just, he's not just taking Google Assistant saying, come on over, let's. So I wonder how effective this, I guess the bottom line on this is, I wonder how effective this is going to be for Apple.
Is it safe to assume that Apple has been actively looking for this caliber?
Yes. That's okay. What I would guess. Yes.
So if that's safe to assume, who were the other candidates out there? You know, why wouldn't they be available or make the cut, if you will?
Well, there's Chi Lu, who worked at Yahoo for a while. He's now at Baidu in China. He was a VP, EVP at Microsoft for Bing, but he's also very he just left Microsoft for Baidu last year. I don't know all the players in this. Google's got like the theoretical smart guys, the Ray Kurzweils of the world, the Peter Norvigs of the world. All of those guys work for Google. I don't know. I bet you're right. I bet that there were a lot of dollar signs in that text and that Apple message.
You know, it's one of those things like, what else could Apple do? They know they're lagging behind in this part of the game. Yeah. And you do what you got to do as long as it ain't cheating.
I do think that you make an interesting point at that there are a limited number of people who are really top of the field, and those people are worth a lot. This is a you know, elite field. Wendy, let's talk about something you're interested in.
Yeah, let's do that.
I feel so bad. To drag you into your Nicene warfare.
Yeah, let's do a safe topic like security.
Security's safe.
Is my VPN on right now? Hold on.
Yeah, no kidding.
Did you switch to the new DNS?
I did. 1.1.1.1.
Yeah.
I did. Steve Gibson has a DNS benchmarking tool, and I ran it, and 1.0 is actually not the fastest DNS available to me. In most cases, most people, I think he said this, most people's own ISP will be faster. But the point of 1.0, which is created by Cloudflare, is that it prevents your ISP from seeing your internet DNS lookups. Your ISP's leaking that information. So it's a privacy.
Speaking of people who know a hell of a lot about you.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more than any social platform.
Well, yes and no. I don't think that's necessarily true, because for instance, your conversation, I agree with you that ISPs absolutely are problematic, but your conversation with Google and Facebook, both of those are protected by HTTPS. They can't see your Google searches. They can't see your Facebook likes. Your ISP can see a lot more. I mean, certainly Comcast, we know, and AT&T and Verizon, we know, are, you know, quickly will hand that information over to third parties if they can get paid for it and have no barrier to law enforcement. So in that respect, ISPs know an awful lot. But on the other hand, I think both Google and Facebook and many other sites have, for a variety of reasons, started to hide that information, not just from ISPs, but from open Wi-Fi and other places that you...
We need a sophisticated discussion about this. I just want to go back for 1 second to the Facebook thing. Washington Post just put up their story on the Zuckerberg press conference, and I quote the headline: Facebook said the personal data of most of its 2 billion users have been collected and shared with outsiders. Well, yeah. I mean, that's such an ignorant headline. Every single profile you have anywhere on the internet has been scraped and used. That's not news. But now we're acting as if, oh my God, the world's coming down. Look at that graphic. Like, oh, the world's unzipped, right? And so we need to talk a lot more about what's really going on with ISPs and with others. Anyway, sorry for that momentary screech.
I guess we're going to get back into this, but...
Well, no, we can. Well, I just, I apologize.
Here's the thing. You know normal people.
I do.
I can't pretend to.
But we don't.
We don't. Jeff and I know nobody normal.
No, we don't.
But a normal person isn't really aware of that.
Nope.
The promise, at least the superficial promise of Facebook, I can show you that BBC interview again with Mark Zuckerberg, is that you can share your personal information with us because we'll keep it private. And you get to choose which of your friends has access to it. That's that whole rigmarole about, oh, Aunt wants to be your friend. Do you want to agree? The implication, you can read the fine print. You're smart, Jeff. You probably understand there's more to it than this. But the implication is, until you agree that information is going to, those pictures you post and all that are going to be shared with somebody, it's not. So this may not be a revelation to you, Jeff, but I think it is a revelation to a lot of people.
But the way that puts it is, if, oh my God, Facebook's been doing this to us. Every single advertiser, every single media company, every single everybody who has anything public has been doing it. Put it in context, please.
Yes, well, we do. Don't you think we do that? Don't we talk about that all the time on every show I do on this network? We talk about that. And I, on the radio show where I feel like I'm trying to talk to normal people, I try to let them know. And I certainly raise this specter of ISPs knowing a lot about you and being very willing to sell it. We know that that's the case.
I know some people that were running, what's that service? Kodi?
Yeah.
And
pirated, probably, right? The pirate version of Kodi, which
the Amazon sticks.
Amazon stick. Kodi itself is just a media platform, but you can put Kodi plugins on there that will get, you know, pirated media. It makes it very easy to watch pirated streams.
You know, and I'm talking to, you know, Joe Schmo or what have you, and they're just super excited about this thing, and they tell me they got this Fire Stick and whatnot, and I say, well, where do you get this from? And they say it comes up on the stick, and yada yada yada, and I say, did you pay for it? No, and I'm trying to, you know, go about it in a...
You're having a Socratic dialogue with them.
You know, and trying to help them put the pieces together. And then I finally just have to tell them, look, that's pirated material. You could get in some serious trouble about that. And they're like, oh, okay. And they just keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, they just don't care. And then I tell them, hey, your cable provider sees every single thing that you're doing. Your internet provider sees every single thing that you're doing. So don't be surprised if you get a phone call, something in the mail, or better yet, someone knocks on your door because you got caught up watching the latest episode of Black-ish, even though you don't own the television, you know?
Right. Well,
Wendy, I apologize. I did that. I caused that detour.
What are we proving
get
here?
Get back to safe territory.
It's just people are ignorant and willfully so. That's why I think this headline from the Post kind of
I understand what you're saying. It has no context.
Yeah.
It acts as if Facebook just invented that today
right.
and confessed that today. That's what the internet has been from day one.
You could probably take this headline. Maybe let me get my red pencil out and cross out Facebook and then just, and Facebook said, and just, and then say the internet users.
Yeah.
Personal data of most internet users has been collected and shared with outsiders.
Oh yeah,
that would not change the accuracy of that headline at all.
So I linked to that. Siva himself came in, and I said in my Facebook, linking to this kind of headline writing will get the internet screwed.
How will it get Siva the internet said, screwed?
Because of the regulation. Now what's going to happen? Mark my words, friends. Mark my words. GDPR is nothing. There's going to be a crackdown on the internet. The internet's evil. It's going to be used by bad guys around the world, including some in this country. And because it comes out of this panic, it comes out of misinformation.
Yeah. Well,
but enough of
it. Yeah, we don't want to shut down the internet. We just want to tell users to be aware. We just want to raise awareness, right?
I said, we'll call it, well, the internet's screwed. Siva said, deservedly. And so I said, so you're anti-internet?
Ooh, that's not good.
Said, is the internet anti-people? This is the kind of discussion that's going on.
Right.
Right. It's affecting the whole net.
Point well proven there. If that's where that discussion
meanwhile,
goes.
Wendy is saving us from the real bad guys. right, Wendy? There are real bad guys on the net who are doing really bad things, and we're paying attention to this kerfuffle.
You know, I was going to say that this kind of discussion really happens in much smaller circles than you would imagine. And the people who are happily using social media all over the place are not privy to it unless they see it in a headline like the one you just read.
Thank you, Wendy.
It may not be news to any of us, but,
I
remember the times when it was a very, very small internet community and we all had the same level of knowledge. We all considered everything to be intuitively obvious because we all thought the same way. And now that the rest of the globe is using this, they have their own concerns, and we have to think very carefully about what they know, which is not the same as what we know. What information is it important for them to know and understand? And do we need to change our practices in technology to accommodate the way the rest of the world is going to be using this tech? Because it's not up to us anymore.
Do you think it's possible? I guess really, is it possible to have services like Facebook and Google and not be subject to surveillance capitalism? Are there business models? Are there? I'm getting Shoshana Zuboff on here the minute that book comes out, Jeff, just to give you a heart attack.
Well, talk about loaded ways to say this. That's the entire
he's just tossing out fresh bait.
Media in the show.
I'm chumming. Is that what you're saying, Ed? I'm just chumming the water. Well, but I mean, I understand we're getting great free services.
Like the show.
And they're advertising supported, and God knows that's what I do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that I do it. Now, maybe this doesn't scale, but I do it in a way that doesn't infringe on the privacy of our listeners. But is it possible to run a Facebook or a Google at great expense without, I guess you could, you have advertising? There are really two concerns. One, I don't actually really mind if advertisers know where I live, how old I am. There's a lot of stuff. It's fine with me. I want to see targeted ads. I'd far prefer to see targeted ads. I'm a little nervous.
Ding, 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 yes.
Well, but then I'm a little nervous about ads that are hyper-targeted to maybe my state of mind or my emotional.
So then set that standard.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So Zuckerberg said in the conference today, he said, people want quality ads, and they define quality as relevant, and the way to get relevance is to know something about you, okay?
Yeah, so but don't advertise against my depressive personality or something, right?
All right, then set the standards. On the other hand, I told a story on the show before, someone who had MS who didn't know it, and it actually had a big impact on him. And so,
They could have gone to the doctor and had the same impact. I mean, it's
he
not.
He didn't know that he should.
I understand.
He didn't know that he should.
I mean, I understand.
And so.
I don't think we use Facebook for its diagnostic value. But
what are the standards of targeting ads? And targeting is not evil. It's the way to higher value in advertising. The existence of a show like this, where, you know, 10 people in the world are willing to watch this for 2 hours.
It democratizes it. It democratizes.
Is highly targeted.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's targeted. That's how I decided to do it, is to do niche programming that would, by default, say, you don't have to know anything about this audience because anybody would listen to this is a certain kind of person. And so that's that advertisers appreciate
it. And nobody apparently wants to
advertise
it.
Apparently not enough advertisers appreciate it, but...
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just kidding. I like working for free. I don't mind it at all.
Let's think a little bit about, I mean, taking it up a level above just advertising.
Please, yes.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about how data is being used and recombined and used again for very specific purposes, I think one of the discussions we need to have is not just what kind of data is being collected, but how it's being used in different contexts. You can almost think of it as chemicals that produce, you know, in certain formulas produce specific reactions. So one example I was just thinking of was after the Newtown massacre. Something that the Journal News did was they published the names and addresses of all handgun permit holders in New York's Westchester and Rockland counties.
Wow.
So this information was always available to the public upon request, but it was the act of collecting it at the individual level and highlighting it to an internet-wide readership in the context of having just been, you know, there's a big political context there right after the massacre. That was the use that was found to be an invasion of privacy and so objectionable. So it was a combination of data that actually was publicly available, but it was highlighting it and in a certain context. So that's the sort of activity with data I think we should be taking a closer look at.
That's, you know, that's a really good point. For instance, you can go to the county seat and get information about who owns every property in the county. Mm-hmm. That's public information. Mm-hmm. But then a company that does that and then puts it online for quick search, it was always public information, but it was never that accessible.
We used to call that the phone book, and we didn't panic about it.
No, but there's
this. Steve Martin now?
Yeah. But it's more than a phone book. I mean, you can find out where I live. Now it used to be you'd have to go to the Sonoma County seat to find that out. Actually,
meanwhile, in Scandinavia, your income is public for all.
Right.
It's public.
You thus pay different fees.
When I was working for the state of Texas, all of the salaries of state employees are publicly available if you file a Public Information Act request. But the Houston Chronicle took all of that data and put it in a database and published it. And the act of publishing it suddenly raised the visibility of that and, again, the focusing of public attention on it to a level that it hadn't been before. And you can imagine that was an issue not just for the employees of the state who could now spend the time and, you know, compare their salaries with somebody else's, but, you know, anybody could now access that very, very easily. So, again, it's what you do with the data and how you combine it in the context of our society that I think we're going to have discussions around.
How do you solve that? Do you say you can't publish it? Do you say, I mean,
or you change our norms in society?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of discussion that points out that our norms in society have not caught up to our technology.
And yeah, but norms won't protect you, Jeff, if your home address is public and somebody decides they don't like you. There's reasons why I would prefer
Ever thus. Leo, come on.
But again, now they can do it. They can do it in 5 seconds instead
of
having to go
on Twitter. I mean,
they could tweet it. They could dox me. Yeah.
Yeah. Doxing is a new activity that is very different from calling information and saying, I want Jeff Jarvis's home phone number.
Right. So, and I don't see that we've really addressed that at all. I mean, that's a big problem. Poor Brianna Wu had to move.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we've addressed that at all, and that's been a known
right,
problem.
Right, but what's the real problem?
The problem's not the internet. I don't know what the solution is.
The problem is that we've got a screwed up society.
Well, you can't fix that.
And we don't
know
how to deal with people who threaten each other, and we don't know how to deal with people who threaten each other. Well, just what we said about the YouTube case. The cops were called. They talked to the woman. She was sleeping in a car. The father was worried. There was nothing they could do.
And rightly so.
I was in California, I tried to get a very dear friend of mine when I lived there who was bipolar when he was running naked through the woods of Monterey. The effort it would take to get him committed because one threw over the cuckoo's nest. We got into such a, pardon me, moral panic about psychiatric care in this country that we did everything we could to keep people from being cared. That's a much higher level problem. Addresses on the internet, not the problem.
How about this one? Grindr, which is Tinder for gay men. Now, I have really mixed opinions on this one. I want to know what you guys think. When you put your Grindr profile up, apparently, one of the things you can fill it is your HIV status and date of last test. I guess if you're a gay guy dating, that's probably important information that you'd want to share with other gay guys who might go out with you. But Grindr was sharing that information, including location and HIV status, with third-party firms.
But those firms, pardon me, read on, because they were not sharing it for it to be used in any way. They were sharing that it was in the data that was being used to check the app.
Right. It was for, yeah.
I know
the people who at Grindr know that this is very sensitive information, right? What's their responsibility there? I mean, the users posted that information in their profile. The Grindr only shared it with other companies for purposes of making their app more reliable.
Right.
Grindr knew it was sensitive information.
Grindr should have been smart enough.
They probably should
have
expurgated it.
Masked that information for any possible use anywhere except by that user. Yes, that was dumb, but it wasn't venal.
Right. And who's at fault? I mean, if you're a user, you did put that stuff on Grindr.
But only for that context,
right.
Not for it to be shared. And I think the problem is that most of the world doesn't understand the technological implications
of how easily
their data can be collected, used, misused, right. Shared, recombined. And it wouldn't occur to them to ask, hey, you're not going to use this for anything else, are you?
Right.
Well, but you see, here's the paradox we enter into. Sorry. Go ahead.
Is it in the terms of service when someone signs up for Grindr that, hey, yes, you have to provide this data?
No, you don't have to provide the data. But it may be that it said, as most terms of service do, your personal information is private, but from time to time, for purposes of improving the service, we may share information with third parties.
Yeah, they cover their rumps. Yeah,
they cover, yeah, so to speak.
Other than they should have,
they claim they anonymized it. As an industry standard practice, Grindr does work with highly regarded vendors to test and optimize how we roll out our platform. These vendors are under strict contractual terms that provide for the highest level of confidentiality, data security, and user privacy. I mean, you could probably also say that Grindr stuff is stored on a server that some other third party owns and presumably might have access to that information. All those things.
Can you put that back up? I wanted to see what the next.
When working with these platforms who restrict information shared except as necessary or appropriate, sometimes this data may include location data or data from HIV status fields, as these are features within Grindr. However, it's always transmitted securely with encryption, and there are data retention policies in place to further protect our users' privacy from disclosure. This is the one that he got. This is the Grindr CEO.
Read number four.
This is the one he got some heat for. It's important to remember that Grindr is a public forum. Some might question that. We give users the option to post information about themselves, including HIV status and lab test date. We make it clear in our privacy policy that if you choose to include this information in your profile, the information will also become public. But I mean, if I'm a user, I'm thinking become public with somebody who's using Grindr and looking for somebody to go out with.
Exactly.
That's why I shared it.
Of context.
Yeah. What does public mean in this context? Does it mean you're going to put it up on a a Times Square billboard? Because that's also public. But I think
could I come along and go through 10 Grindr accounts and get that information? Yeah, I could.
You could.
Public is public. Public is public.
I don't think it is. Yeah, I don't think real people would say that.
Well, you keep saying that. I'm sorry. As a journalist, I also want to defend the definition of public. I wrote a book about this, where I think that there is not a presumption of privacy in public. When I see the mayor walking into a brothel, he can't turn around and say, "Well, you know, you're not allowed to see that." That only happens in totalitarian, authoritarian regimes. In this country, I am allowed to see that, and I am allowed to repeat that. The knowledge that I have then becomes mine. That is just reality.
I think the problem is that now with technology and the social media that we have, anyone can become a public figure at the drop of a hat without realizing, you know, without having signed up for it. In other words, yes, you know, the mayor is a public figure. It comes with the job. They can expect certain exposure and certain highlighting of their activities. But, you know, the person who was who is caught in the middle of a news breaking event and tweets something and suddenly becomes famous, that can happen to any of us at any time.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody's prepared to deal with that.
Well, so Wendy, I walk down the street and I throw litter on the street, and you're walking along and you say, "Shame on that bozo." You take a picture of me, you put it on Instagram. That's my tough luck. I'm on the public street. I did something in public. No, I wasn't intending to be famous, but you make a cause celeb out of me. Smart ass, loudmouth, journalism prof and podcaster, people we really want to get because we don't like them, are slobs. Well, yeah, I did it. I did it in public. Didn't intend to afford the world, but tough.
Let me propose a hypothetical. I'm gay. I live in one of the 28 states, more than half, in which I could be fired for being gay. Period. 28
wow,
states.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So let's say I live in one of those 28 states. Now, I want to use Grindr because I want to meet guys. Is it fair to say, oh, well, if you're in one of those 28 states, don't use Grindr? Or
is it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. But
because what you change in that case is that law. That is exactly the right case. This is what Dana Boyd taught me years ago. The gathering of knowledge is not what you go after. It's the use of the knowledge. And if that's the case, then, yeah, you shouldn't use Grindr in that state because you are liable. And that's wrong. What you change is the law. You change the law. That's what a democracy is about.
So don't use Grindr until the law is changed.
No. I mean, because you are at risk.
You're in that situation.
That's the technically right answer, but I think there's a lot of people
who would say, it's an awful answer,
well, but I'm going to use Grindr because only other gay people would use Grindr, so it's safe.
Leo, what's the fundamental problem in that equation? You and I have to agree with that. What's wrong there is the law. What's wrong there is the behavior of firing people.
I agree, but...
And technology can't fix that.
No, but I think that it wouldn't... I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't look at somebody and say, "Well, you asked for it, dude." If they use Grindr, assuming that, well, only other gay people will see this, so I'm safe.
But you can't. That's why number four warns you and says, "You put this up here."
Well, they need to put that in big letters when you first get Grindr. They need to put in big letters.
I don't know,
you shouldn't use it in these 28 states. Because you're posting publicly, in effect, that you're gay.
Believe me, having watched people in the day be frightened to death of losing their jobs, they know.
Well, but yeah, but I don't think they know now. I think that they assume that they're
and
safe.
I think the big issue of our society today is we are still discovering what can be done and misused about at scale. With data, especially personal data. And I think the big reaction that we see over and over again is, well, not like that. And that's, again, where social norms have to be adjusted. They have to come back in because nobody, I think, really understands the extent of where we're going with all of this data. And every time we run up against something like this and think, yeah, I realized that it was public, but I did not understand just how widely, you know, it could be interpreted as public. I made certain assumptions based on my understanding, and they turned out to be wrong, but I had no way of knowing. And that's,
so, Wendy, what do you suggest that the standard should be then? That you can't, nobody can do anything public unless they've signed lots of releases and waivers?
See, I think that's all very extremist. I think because we have more visibility into people's actions and can do activities such as, for example, public shaming at a scale that we have never experienced before as a human race, we're having to reexamine all of the assumptions that we have. And there used to be social norms about what you could do to shame somebody, for example. What was over the top? What was appropriate? And we simply have to readjust these based on the contact that we all have around the globe now, because it's unprecedented in our human history.
I certainly agree, Wendy. This is about readjusting norms, and we're in the process of doing that. And I find great hope. If you look at the Laura Ingraham case, where somebody famous went after a teenager, and the reaction that then occurred was society saying, "Yep, we're going to make up a new norm now. You just went over it."
So you don't you disagree with The Hill, who says that's a troubling precedent.
I do disagree. Yeah. I do disagree. We each have each company has a right to decide what they want to associate with. We as consumers have a right to decide what we associate with. And, you know, Martin Luther King, on this day we note, did a lot of boycotts. And that's how he got a lot of the economic pressure. The only pressure that his community had was economic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't have a problem with it either. But it's there are
it
those.
It can be used for bad, too. Every tool can be.
Yeah. Here's an interesting
interesting
example. I don't know if this is moral panic. You can be the judge of that, Jeff. You're the king.
I am the judge.
You're the judge of moral panic. Chrome is scanning files on your computer and people are freaking out.
But what's the last line of that subhead says?
There's no reason to freak out, says Motherboard's Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchiere.
The big headline says freak out. The little headline says no, don't freak out.
So the reason people are freaking out is, well, it's one of those things that's benign, right, so Wendy? It's Chrome, your browser, saying, well, let me look at your documents folder and see if there's any malware in there.
No, they're not even looking at the documents folder. If you look at the postings on Twitter from Justin Xu, who I think was quoted in that article that you're highlighting, he leads Google Chrome security and desktop engineering. He talks about what this does, the Chrome cleanup tool. It's not a system-wide scanner filter, as he writes. It runs weekly. It scans browser hijacking points, which may cause it to follow links elsewhere. In other words, it's patrolling the security of the browser, which is you would expect the browser to do that. I think that's a great feature for it to be doing. It's a very heavily sandboxed subset of ESET. And but in checking some things out to see where they go, they may follow, you know, other links. So, again, there's a lot of technical detail in what Google has done here that was completely lost in the discussion. And the problem is that Google itself, their security team doesn't have marketing per se. All the information about what they're doing with consumer features and security is on their security blog, which is great, except consumers usually don't know it exists and they don't go read it. So this is another case where, you know, most of the rest of the world does not understand the details, the technical details of this, and you know, they're not being communicated in a very user-friendly way. They're being communicated in a tech-friendly way.
Right.
And you and I might go look for that security blog, but the rest of our neighbors down the street won't think to do that.
Well, so here's the way it was. By the way, it is. If you read the terms of service, it's just nobody does. It is stated in the terms of service Chrome will do this. So it isn't something undisclosed. As you said, it wasn't disclosed by a marketing team. It was disclosed by a technology team. But Kelly Shortridge, who is a sophisticated user, discovered it because she had a Canary token in her document folder. So, by the way, we should mention Canary is the Thinks company is a sponsor. But so she had a phony document file that was there to warn her if somebody was accessing her document folder, and it was triggered, and it was Chrome. So you can. So this is a good example of.
But where, are we better off with Chrome, Wendy? Are we better off with Chrome doing this than not?
Oh, I would say so. Yes, Wendy. Yeah.
I believe that they have worked very, very hard on protecting users, and they've done more than, you know, a lot of other companies have. But the problem is that, you know, nothing happens in isolation. And these sorts of features, the more sophisticated they get, the more they have to branch off into areas where we start, you know, getting nervous and thinking, well, what about our privacy? So, it's a very difficult line for them to walk.
Yeah. So they do. They may go in following these hijackers. They may go into your documents folder, but they're not looking randomly at documents.
Yeah, if they're following links that they may have reason to believe is, you know, are suspicious, they may need to go check them out at the hijack points within the browser and say, okay, you know, what are we really looking at here? So the question is, how far do you want your software to go in an effort to protect you from attackers?
Yeah.
How much of this do you want them to do for you? And, do you have the knowledge to be able to say, I want you to go this far, but not any further, and really understand the implications of what you're asking for?
I have to say, sometimes I feel like Google acts a little bit nanny-ish. Things like kind of pushing HTTPS. Yes, that's all well and good, and everybody should use it. Deprecating, what was it? The 1024
URL shortener.
Well, no, not, yeah, we can talk about that in a bit. But remember, they deprecated keys, 1024 keys, a little early. Mm-hmm. Earlier than that was a problem, or maybe there were 2048-bit keys. It was earlier than it was a problem. Both Microsoft and Google agreed to do this, but Google advanced the deadline, causing problems. People had to go out and get new certificates. And I understand that this is a really good example of engineers have a different mindset. They don't really – this is good for everybody. We're going to just do this. And they maybe don't understand the political issue – the issue of dealing with humans quite as well.
Well, I think it's the atmosphere of trust or lack thereof. We trusted Google to do this. We trusted Facebook. Now, because of all this hoo-ha, and we have been debating legitimacy of that hoo-ha, there is now a lack of trust, and they have to deal with that in a whole different light, and they're not used to it.
Well, I trust Google, and you trust Google, but wouldn't you be surprised if you had a thing in your documents folder that said, hey, Chrome just was looking in your documents folder? You would kind of want to know, well, what? Why was that?
I guess I don't quite understand it, the technology here, but isn't this the same type of security can try to stop the mining software from being installed on my machine because I went to some whatever website?
There's a lot of safe browsing work that Google has done, both, you know, from a search perspective and, you know, from a Chrome engineering perspective. And the stuff is all there in their security blog. But again, is it in a format that typical users, not us, but right. typical users, you know, will know to look for and understand? There's a lot of usability issues that we have to reexamine right away.
All right.
So I'm just going to quickly show you where it says this. This has been in the Chrome terms of what is this? This is the Chrome security blog. This is they've been saying this since January 2017. It's actually a white paper on Chrome security. And if you scroll really far down into unwanted software protection, Chrome periodically scans your device to detect potentially unwanted software. Actually, this is another example of where the marketing team might have said, you know, you shouldn't call this heading unwanted software protection, because what you're protecting against is unwanted software. But it sounds like what you're saying is that your software protection is unwanted. Anyway,
need for a hyphen.
Yeah.
Each shoots a leaves.
This is an engineer writing this. And I love engineers. I love that mindset. But
I do too.
But maybe they don't quite get that people might misunderstand it. Chrome periodically scans your device to detect potentially unwanted software. That's what they said. Look, we told you we were going to do this. It's right here in paragraph 34, subsection A, under unwanted software protection. Surely you read that. Anyway, I'm glad they do it. I think it's harmless, but I understand people's concern.
Yeah, I mean, by contrast, I have to tell you the story of one of my kids who we caught. We used to let him use a computer before he could actually read, and he was, clicking around on software. And one day we caught him in the middle of downloading and almost installing a browser plugin.
Right.
And we couldn't figure out what was going on there until we figured out that even though he couldn't read yet, he had learned that on if a pop-up window appeared,
click yes.
and there were two choices. One of them would be highlighted more than the other one, and if you clicked that one, then it would go away and things would.
I'm a good boy. Look what I did. I'm a good boy.
So he figured out how to do that. He intuited that by himself until he got to the EULA. And the EULA agree or disagree, neither choice was highlighted by default, so he didn't know what to pick. And that stuck. So this is the sort of thing that users of all ages and all, different cultures and different levels of understanding are dealing with.
Yes.
And, we have got to re-engineer how we work with users and what the user experience is like, because nobody's going to read these white papers. I can't. Nobody outside of technology is going to read these white papers.
I didn't even read it.
Put it on Facebook. They'll read it there.
Yeah, right.
Make it into a meme. Then it's okay.
Right.
Now, at Carnegie Mellon University, there's a usability and privacy research group that is working on a lot of these issues, trying to figure out what privacy means, what usability actually means, and working to redesign these things so that they can be understandable. And I think that's a very important effort, but it's going to have to spread a lot further throughout technology. We really have to emphasize usability and better cultural understanding.
Yeah, it's really an interesting issue. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to synthesize a general statement. And I think that the problem really is, and we've said this before, that 99% of users are reliable and trustworthy and respectful and so forth. There are bad actors, though, 1%. And what we really underestimated was that the power that all of these internet tools would give the 1%. And it's a little, and it's now overwhelming us, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, malware.
Which is a problem of responsibility. I mean, Ev Williams said that South by Southwest. He said we didn't anticipate the bad behavior.
Yeah.
We should have. We know that now.
Yeah.
We didn't. We didn't have enough people like Wendy, seriously, to say, let me look at the dark side here, anticipate the problem, and protect against it.
Goes back to the days of operating systems. You know, when they designed operating systems, they weren't designed to defend against, malefactors.
And they weren't designed for people who didn't know how to use them.
Yes, they're designed for engineers.
Engineers for engineers. Yeah. Exactly. And so the first step when you start looking at software is seeing how it can be accidentally broken and accidentally misused, and you need to protect against that. And then from there, it's just another short step to malice and say, now, if somebody were trying to break this on purpose, what would happen? And yeah, there are a lot of us in the security community that sit around thinking these bad thoughts all day, but it's certainly not what normal people think about.
When did that shift happen, Wendy? When did we start really kind of thinking, oh, we got to really think of worst case scenarios?
I think it's been, those who have been defending against state actors for decades have already been thinking this way. I think just as technology has spread out into the hands of the rest of the world and regular users, the expansion of bad actors has increased proportionately, and the types of different bad actions that are being taken, all sorts of fraud and abuse and monetization and bullying. There was a great talk by Alex Stamos at Facebook about what they consider to be their threat model. And at the very top, there's just a little tiny bit that has to do with state actors and those sort of attacks. Way at the bottom, the biggest thing that they have to defend against is users of their platform abusing other users.
Yeah.
And that's their biggest problem. Yeah. So, these sorts of threat models change very much depending on the software, depending on the user base, and the functionality, and we don't understand all of it yet, but we need to spend a lot more time thinking about it.
When you learn software design, in fact, even if you don't learn it, you might even intuit it, but especially when you learn it, you learn to test for edge cases. You learn to look for crazy inputs. You kind of, the bad actor for software design is, you know, that's how you avoid bugs, is just crazy inputs and, you know, unexpected things. And you, and as a good software designer, you design software really testing for the edge cases. That's very, very, very important.
Sanitize it.
Yeah. And then it gets to, if you've got user input, you've got to sanitize your inputs. And this is well known, but I think we're now seeing this at a more macro scale with, I mean, you know, Twitter and Facebook and everything else, that you really have, you have to plan for the worst, even at a larger level, at a higher level. And we're not very good at planning for software errors and sanitizing our inputs. We're even worse at planning for bad actors. I think most of us just assume people are like us. They're nice.
And what kind of nice work do you do?
And they understand the same sorts of things. But yeah, nobody is getting into the head of the 4-year-old and saying, how are they going to intuit this user interface?
That's a good point.
You know, nobody's thinking of the edge case where, one person in a family has one social security number and they share it throughout the family because nobody else has one.
Right.
There are so many cultural differences that, diversity is going to have to solve. That there's a lot of research, for example, that we put into our usability at Duo, but we still run into edge cases all the time. And you just have to realize that whatever you're designing it for is going to be around for much longer than you ever anticipated it was going to be. It's going to be used by a user base you cannot fully picture and imagine in your head. And you have to be ready to adjust at a moment's notice.
Sina had
Did I just cast a bummer over?
No, not at all. No.
I think this is
really the fundamental conversation we've been having all along. Really, how do you do that now, especially retroactively, which is really challenging? How do you do that? How do you solve for this problem? How do you democratize speech and still handle the bad actors? And I don't know. I think it's very, very hard.
It's very hard.
How Chromebooks became go-to laptops for security experts. Would you agree? Are CISOs,
I like this.
Are
yes,
CISOs
indeed.
Using
yes,
Chromebooks?
Indeed.
Yay.
Yes, indeed, says Wendy.
we use them heavily at Duo. In fact, my travel laptop is a Chromebook because there's nothing resident on it. Although, you know, those of us who have been around a long time are seeing the, fat and thin client thing waxing and waning over the decades. And now we're going back to thinner is better. The less you have on that particular piece of hardware, the better. But again, because of the additional security functionality that Google is engineering in there, yes, it is turning out to be a very practical use case for enterprises as well as for individual users.
If you go to a DEF CON or Black Hat, you don't bring a Windows laptop. You don't bring a Mac. You bring a Chromebook. Swift on security 5 years ago. No, 3 years ago. Mentored someone on teaching computing basics to seniors. What antivirus should I buy? Buy a Chromebook. But what about buy a Chromebook? That was 3 years ago. But that's true.
And if you get on the school bus, what do you bring with you?
Oh, I love this story. So Google, this was a pilot program they did in North Carolina. They did it in some rural areas where people spend a lot of times, poor students, spend a lot of times on school buses.
With bad shocks.
Yes.
Bouncing along rural country roads. And where are you in North Carolina, South Carolina?
I grew up in South Carolina, but right now I live right outside of Charlotte.
Charlotte.
North Carolina.
So
nice.
A lot of kids.
I know all about those country roads, trust me.
Spend as much as 3 hours a day in a school bus.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
I know all about that. You get on the bus at 6 a.m. and you're at the school at 8.
Oh, my God. So what do? You besides throwing spit wads?
You give them all Google buses.
You give them Google buses. And they're going to roll out more of these. It's been a successful pilot for a while, I guess, in North Carolina and South Carolina over the last couple of years. They put Wi-Fi in the school bus. They put Chromebooks in the school bus. They call it the Rolling Study Halls Initiative. I'm thinking that probably a lot of kids are not studying on these
Chromebooks. I like the initiative, but you just think about how often you can walk outside. I don't care if it's small town Petaluma. And you see someone that's under the age of 18, they're doing this. And I guarantee you they're not researching for whatever assignment that they had that week.
Unless the paper is due that morning and they didn't do it last night.
Yeah.
Not if you're my kids. I dare them to do.
No last minute studying for them, huh?
No.
Each rolling study hall also has an onboard educator who could provide direct assistance. This is a really?
Really?
This is, yeah, to me, this is.
That's expensive.
This is what Apple should have done. Instead of releasing a not much cheaper iPad with a pencil support, Apple really could have done something innovative and supportive. This is in 12 states now, 16 districts, Alabama, Colorado, Georgia, Kansas, Minnesota, New Mexico, Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas, and Virginia. Of course, you know, it's going to work best where people are spending a lot of time. The average bus route in the Gamewell Middle School population is 1.5 hours in the morning and 1.5 hours in the afternoon. That's Caldwell County, North Carolina. Wow. Your kids don't spend that much time in the bus, do they, Aunt?
Yes, sir, they do.
Oh, my God.
One of them does.
Really?
Wow.
You do. And the funny thing is, the school is roughly 6 miles from my home.
Oh, no. What? They could walk faster.
Miles. Right. And that's the thing. There's been a time or two where I said, hey, go ahead and walk. You know, and
they don't have enough bus routes. What is it?
Right. I think it comes down to
they're on the wrong side of the bus route. They pick them up on the way out instead of on the way back.
That's exactly what happens. You know, and there's only so many buses out here. There's been times where I've found that the my younger son's bus driver, you know, after he or she finishes the route, they go to the other route for the high school.
Mm-hmm. You know, right.
It's just double duty, and I think it's all budget myself.
It probably is.
Yeah. Oh. But how can you arrive at school? I mean, number one, high school starting earlier is ridiculous because the high school kids are more somnambulant. But how can you arrive at school fresh to think when you an hour and a half on the bus? Jesus.
Yeah, I always slept. But I wasn't a normal kid either.
Yeah. You could bicycle pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, that's sad.
So soon we'll have the self-driving buses, and then the bus driver can be the teacher running, and there will be a classroom, and it'll be fun.
I mean, I don't know how well this scales. I'm sure it's expensive, but I just commend Google for doing it. I think
I think it's a great idea. You know, it's just the matter of policing it and seeing what all is going on within that network.
Right.
I like the idea that my kids can use that classroom. Is that what it's called? Google Classroom?
Yes.
And, you know, they can share information with me and the teachers can do the same thing.
Do they use it?
Everybody's connected. Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
And everybody's connected and I'm sort of always in the loop. But I got a hunch when they're on the school bus, especially after school, the last thing on their mind is I need to make sure I read chapter 10 tonight. You know, they're probably trying to get on Snapchat and
I am so glad my kids are grown. I couldn't handle it if my kids
were. I'm counting down.
Well, my stepson's 15, so I have to. But he'd rather play video games than Snapchat. How old are your kids, Ant?
I still don't know. There's sixth grade and ninth grade. I don't know the ages. Okay.
That's not his father.
No.
Yep.
Dad doesn't need to know that.
No, they're not old enough to work.
Yeah, we have a ninth grader as well. Yeah. It's yeah. Mm. He actually can take the train, which is nice. He could. We now have a light rail from Petaluma to Marin. That's where he goes to school. And
that sucks.
That is really great. So he has a little, we got him a little electric scooter. So he picks the train in Petaluma, gets on the light rail. It's a really nice, beautiful 20-minute smooth ride. Then there's another mile and a half to school, and he rides his electric scooter to school. Or
some Charlotte kids do that. Yeah. They take the light rail instead of the bus.
Mass transit. Hallelujah. We need more of that. Google has added now, they call it making it easier to plan for the weekend. Google search on Android and soon iOS will, if you're Fandango or Flixster, you got to be nervous about this. In search, you can say what movies are showing. It'll show you the movies in the theaters near you. You can even buy tickets on your phone, all without leaving the Google search results.
Oh, I didn't see that in the rundown.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I didn't either. It was Scooter X in our chat room said this just came out.
Yay.
Nice. I saw Ready Player One, by the way. Have you seen it yet?
Yes, no. I've seen it.
What'd you think, Wendy?
You know, I grew up in that era and everything, but I was not a gamer boy.
Right.
And so, yes, I played games, but I've just... and probably not of the right mindset to appreciate it as much, you know, as it should be. I think Spielberg did a great job with it. I sat up right in the front row to get as much of the VR experience as I possibly could.
Holy crap.
It was just so 80s in terms of, you know, the protagonist who I could not identify with at all. And you know, all of the 80s references, I was like, yes, that's very nice. I remember all of those. I don't know why the nostalgia didn't grab me.
I loved it, but I was that kid. And the game that they play at the end, I won't say anything about it, but it has an Easter egg. And I remember when that game was the hot game, I played it and I found the Easter egg and I did all of that stuff. So it kind of resonated a little more for me. I think geeks will enjoy it, or anybody likes 80s trivia.
Yeah, although I feel that when you have something like, you know, that's wonderfully, you know, broader culturally speaking, like and high tech, like Black Panther.
Oh, I love that.
I just think there's no comparison. You know, it just makes something like Ready Player One look a lot more dated.
That's actually a good point. Black Panther was remarkably good.
It was amazing.
Yeah,
it really was.
My friend Charlie Hoover and also Dan Patterson had got me onto Ready Player One, the book.
Right.
And I just kept putting it off and putting it off, and I ended up using Audible to do the audio book.
Will Wheaton reads it, yeah.
And I thought it was okay. I think I would have enjoyed that book probably 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, but it just didn't do much for me. I get all of the 80s stuff. I grew up in that time. But I didn't start playing D&D until maybe 2 years ago. You know, it just is.
Oh, you got some catching up to do.
You know, I played ball. When I was a kid, I had all of those gaming systems and whatnot. But at the same time, I went outside and we played basketball and hide and seek and things like that. I didn't spend a lot of time with the video games the way the book portrayed kids spending time in the 80s playing video
games.
You
had a life.
I ain't gonna say all that. I had a mom that said, you better get your butt outside, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
I really liked Mark Rylance in it. He plays James Halliday.
Yes.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite actors, and normally a very serious actor. He was in Wolf Hall, and he's really good. And he plays almost borderline autistic game developer, who's kind of starts this whole ball rolling in this book, James Halliday. And he does it with, I think it's so charming. He really is the innocent, and I really enjoyed his performance in this. He was really, really good. I agree with you, though. I didn't like the book that much initially, and I thought it was kind of cliched and not great. But then now that I've seen
I look forward to seeing the movie either way because of Spielberg. And I love CGI. It's a very Spielberg movie. All of that.
Yeah. I actually am reading the book now that I started the book four or five times. I've had it in my Audible account for a couple of years. But now that I saw the movie, I'm reading the book and really enjoying it, actually. I'm kind of mad at myself. Yeah. But, it's worth seeing. It's worth seeing. Let's see. Google.
You want a little break here?
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with technology.
Yeah.
It's my favorite story.
Okay.
Written forever.
Yes.
It is seagulls and pepperoni.
I saw you put this in the rundown.
People have been talking about this. It's long. It is the greatest. It is the greatest, the greatest, the greatest. Guy goes to a hotel in Vancouver. He's from Halifax. He brings a suitcase filled with pepperoni because his Navy buddies want the pepperoni. He has a whole suitcase filled with it because it's Navy. He's buying it for a whole ship.
Yeah.
They lost the bag. He gets the bag. He gets in the hotel. There's no refrigerator.
Uh-oh.
But he figures he better kind of cool it, and it's cold outside because it is, after all, Canada.
Uh-oh.
So he opens the window, and he puts the pepperoni on a table. He leaves for 4 or 5 hours. He comes back. He had no way to know that seagulls must like pepperoni.
They like anything.
Anything.
He walked into the room, and the room was filled with seagulls with a pepperoni. Now, when seagulls do eat the pepperoni, you can imagine what it does to their digestive system.
It comes out the other end.
Yeah, there was that. Plus, they tend to slobber. He didn't know seagulls slobbered, so that was all over the room. He's going crazy. He opens the windows, trying to get the seagulls out. One seagull, he throws his shoe out.
He threw the shoe at the seagull, and it goes out the window.
The shoe goes out. Then he puts a towel around it, around another one to get it out. It goes out with the towel. It wasn't hurt, but it was like the BKRP scene. Seagulls surrounded in towels can't fly. There's some kind of nice, wonderful little tea going on.
This is at a fancy hotel, I have to tell you.
Very fancy.
Yeah.
Very fancy. So then he comes back and he
says, it's all happened fairly quickly, and this is mid-afternoon. The Empress hosts a very famous, very popular high tea. I suspect this is where the large group of tourists was heading when they were struck first by my shoe, then by a seagull bound up in a towel.
So then he goes out, he sneaks out, he gets the shoe, he gets the towel, he comes back, he cleans off the shoe, but he's a big important business meeting, and then one shoe is wet. So he puts the hairdryer into the shoe to dry it. The hairdryer buzzing.
This is not true. Crazy. Is this made up?
It is. The hotel verified it. The hairdryer vibrates itself out while he's on the phone and goes into a sink. But it wasn't working well, so he took out the power in half the hotel.
Oh, my God. The GFI didn't protect the hotel. Fries the hotel circuitry. He calls the front desk and says, can someone help me clean up a mess? He says, I can still remember the look on the lady's face when she opened the door. I had absolutely no idea what to tell her, so I just said, I'm sorry, and I went to dinner. When I came back, my things had been moved to a much smaller room. I thought that was the end of it all until I was told my company had received a letter banning me from the Empress Hotel, a ban I have respected for almost 18 years. I have matured, and I admit responsibility for my actions. I come to you, Empress Hotel, hat in hand, to apologize for the damage I had indirectly come to cause.
Because after all, in Canada, apologizing is an art.
It is an art. This is the most artful apology.
It is the best Canadian apology ever.
He immediately became a peasant.
Did the Empress let him back in?
They let him back in. They let him back in, and he brought a box of Brothers pepperoni from Halifax for them.
The Empress is a Fairmont.
It's a really fancy hotel. So I just love that story so much. It has nothing to do with technology, nothing to do with Google, but what do we care? I love that story. So it's going all around the internet.
That's gold.
That is. And you see, this is why we need Twitter.
This is exactly why the internet's good. I found it on Facebook, by the way.
Oh, well, it's on Twitter.
You wouldn't have seen it there, but I did.
Yeah. It's not too late. You know, they give you 2 weeks to back out. And I backed out once before because my poor wife said, but now I'm not married to anybody. I'm merely married. It doesn't say a name. So I relented. And then I thought, no, I'm not going to relent. So I deleted it again. But I'm still extended the 2 week.
Are you still married?
I am. Well, that's the funny thing, isn't it, Wendy? She's married to me. She's still married to me. She never stopped being. It's just on Facebook. She just says she's not. So. Mm-hmm.
What did Ant just do?
Did you just do something,
Ant? I had to fix my lighting.
Since oh, okay. I thought, I thought you were encouraging me.
Blocking our view. I thought you were going private on us, Ant.
Google employees have written 3,100 strong saying Google should get out of, this is like college, get out of the Pentagon research.
Yeah, but business. They got a point. Because it's research to do AI, to do identification of photos, to guide drones.
Oh, well. What? So you think that maybe there's some merit to that, that they shouldn't be doing that?
I do. A company, but people get freaked out by seeing, now they don't own Boston Dynamics anymore, but they got freaked out by Google, you know, having cute dog robots.
Right.
That's one matter.
Dear Sundar, begins the letter, we believe that Google should not be in the business of war. Therefore, we ask that Project Maven be canceled, that Google draft, publicize, and enforce a clear policy stating that neither Google nor its contractors will ever build warfare technology. And I know a lot of people watching the show are saying, pretty typical California, right?
I'm not sure what to think of that, though.
I know. I'm also conflicted because you could make the argument that we're, you know, they're helping the defense of the United States.
My freedoms.
Yeah. So I'm not. I don't know. Mixed feelings about this. This is very much like a college campus. I can remember these battles going on all the time when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Back in our day.
Yeah, because universities routinely took Defense Department contracts. Company Google describes its work on Project Maven as non-offensive. I don't think they mean it's not offensive. They mean it's not for use in offensive warfare. Again, engineers really need to work on English.
The language. Here.
Yeah. I love engineers. It's all binary.
The Pentagon's, by the way, in this case, non-offensive does not take a hyphen.
No.
Because non as a prefix does not take a hyphen.
They could have said maybe, if they had said maybe something like not for for offensive purposes, something like that. You know, you're going to have to teach me the red pencil techniques. I need to learn how to
do the little squiggle. The squiggle.
Oh, squiggle. That's like red.
Elite.
I need a. Yeah. I need a tighter line here. And then. Jeff, do you use those in students' papers? Do you? You've seen that before, huh?
Oh, yeah. I did it with my kids' papers. My poor kids.
Do you have a red pencil? See, with the new Surface Studio, I got a pencil of any color at any time. Let's just see here.
Well, aren't you fancy?
Aren't I fancy?
I still dig my Wacom tablet.
Stet. Yeah, this is like a Wacom tablet right on the screen. The Pentagon uses video analysis in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations. So, but that's not offensive. That's defensive, right? Or is it offensive? I don't know if it's offensive. I'm not offended.
Wendy, do you know this stuff? You're in security.
Yeah. Sometimes offensive can be both. But has anybody looked at the Wikipedia page for IBM?
Oh, no.
International Business Machines during World War II.
They were surely used in defense.
They were used in Nazi Germany. Yes.
By Nazis.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. They were used to tabulate census and counts. And that's a good point. IBM did that. And I drove a Volkswagen for
years. The IBM product line, according to the Wikipedia article, shifted from tabulating equipment to Sperry and Norden bomb sights, Browning automatic rifle, and the M1 turbine and engine parts.
Oh my God!
So you know, there's a long and storied precedent for this.
There's a book published in 2001 called IBM and the Holocaust: The Strategic Alliance Between Nazi Germany and America's Most Powerful Corporation. Yikes! They supported genocide through tabulation and generation of punch cards. They created gun sights. Oh, my goodness. Company's response. Let's see what the company said. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, so, I think the point is that especially with the sort of widely used and all-purpose software and data that we make today, you can use it for just about anything.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's that same thing again, right? It's the same problem. It's a double-edged sword. Here's the problem with face recognition. It can be used in a lot of less benign ways. For instance, the Google employees are concerned that it might be used in analysis of drone video to pick out human targets for drone strikes. But it could also be used to pick out civilians to make sure that they don't get hit.
Safety, yeah.
So, but Sundar Pichai said yesterday, any military use of machine learning naturally raises valid concerns. We're actively engaged across the company in a comprehensive discussion of this important topic. He says, these exchanges are hugely important and beneficial. I think that's true. The company also said that Project Maven was specifically scoped to be for non-offensive purposes. Let's see what else. Google might be making a new Pixel phone, a cheaper model, perhaps.
But not for us.
Not for us. For the developing world, probably, right? Mm-hmm. This is particularly for India. According to four senior industry executives who talked to ET Tech, Google is working on a mid-range Pixel 3 phone, actually several types of products for India, including smart home products like the Nest and the Google Home, even the Pixel Book. Maybe we'd see a cheaper Pixel Book. Boy, that would be nice.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to have that. Yeah. Oh, I can't get it here.
You can't get a Pixel Book? Oh, yeah.
I thought the cheaper one.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm sure there's ways. Yeah. There will be ways.
Yeah. Do you use Pixelbook, Ed? A Pixel?
I used to use a
Chromebook?
I used to use a Chromebook quite heavily, but the more I got into editing video, I had to step away from it.
Yeah, right.
I would love to see Chrome extensions for some of the more professional uses. You know, we were talking earlier today, Windows Weekly, about the fact that Microsoft is, in Mary Jo Foley's words, demoting Windows. That they've reorganized again, and they're focusing more on services and cloud than they are on Windows. That they see their future in the cloud. And what it really is a longstanding trend away from, you know, kind of operating systems and desktop computing toward cloud computing.
Were they doing that ages ago?
Well, and Apple's doing the same thing, right? Apple's starting to do the same thing with Macintosh. They really don't seem like they care much about the Mac at all. But I think that's as much users as it is. You know, iOS is so successful. I don't know if Microsoft says that in so many words, but the fact that they fired or let go or really, I don't know what, they demoted the guy, Terry Myerson, the guy in charge of Windows. And they split, and they took the Windows and Devices division and split it up. Really, is a demotion. It means it's less important to their overall future. You're right. There's two groups of people who are really disadvantaged by this. One is creatives like you, Ant, videographers, photographers. The other is gamers who still use Windows machines. Those are the top game machines. Yep. Meanwhile, Intel released today the i9. It's a very confusing 6-core mobile processor, I think, for the mobile gaming segment, I guess. I don't know. For laptops. All right. We got it. Before we wrap this up, we've got to talk about President Trump and Amazon.
Oh, boy.
Yep.
I think it's pretty obvious.
Let me take another drink. Hold
on. The president's not a fan of Jeff Bezos because of the Washington Post. He really does think that the Washington Post is the Amazon's propaganda arm.
But most of the coverage isn't really focusing on that. Most of the coverage is focusing on you know, the postal stuff,
postal
which is
service.
Complete lies.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I think it's, you know, not a good precedent for the president of the United States to target companies.
Amen. Full disclosure, I own the stock, so I'm pissed.
Yeah. And it certainly it has hurt the stock, right? Although,
yep.
I think eventually the stock market kind of wakes up and says, oh, come on. And the Postal Service We should point out the Postal Service is going to every house, almost every house in the country anyway. It's on the way.
Right.
So if Amazon doesn't use them for delivery, it doesn't save them money. And in fact, if Amazon, even if Amazon has a negotiated lower rate with the Postal Service, which I expect they do, I'm sure they do.
Which is a standard open, it's a standard open rate that everybody has.
Right.
Yeah.
Then every box that Amazon gives the Postal Service is money to the Postal Service. They're going there anyway.
Tomorrow I'm going to be a part of a panel for the 8th version of the Postal Vision 2020 conference in Washington.
You did this last year. I think this is great. I've done this before.
It's great. It's a postal conference. They had Amazon speak today, and I couldn't be there. Tomorrow they have Jamie Siminoff speaking.
From Ring, our sponsor. And the newest Amazon acquisition.
Rethinking delivery entirely as an industry, and the poor Postal Service is saddled with all this pension stuff that Congress won't fix them with, but the Postal Service does not use tax dollars. Well, there's two things going on here. One is Washington Post, and the other one is some say that Trump is just wildly jealous of a real billionaire.
No. There is true. And then the reason the market's reacting is not so much this Postal Service thing, but the fact that Trump's trying to get the Pentagon to cancel Amazon's pending multi-billion-dollar cloud services contract with the Pentagon.
Well, Sarah Sanders said, no, he's not involved in that.
No, he's not even allowed to. Actually, if the president interferes with bidding or contractual, that's actually illegal. But that doesn't mean he won't try, and it doesn't mean he won't succeed.
Exactly.
So no love lost between Trump and Bezos. Trump has told advisors, according to Vanity Fair, that he believes Bezos uses the paper as a political weapon. One former White House official said Trump looks at the Post the same way he looks at the National Enquirer. What?
Well, the National Enquirer is a political weapon in his behalf.
Ah.
All right.
let me just say for a minute, I now believe that the Washington Post is the finest newspaper in America. It's the one I start with every morning.
More than the Times.
Marty Baron, I do. And Marty Baron is the best editor in America. And I have complete, absolute, and utter trust and respect for Marty that he would never, ever allow a Sinclair to be pulled on him and have words put in his mouth.
Oh, you must love that Sinclair story. Wow.
Oof.
I watched John Oliver on Sunday.
What happened with Sinclair?
So Sinclair Media, which is a conservative-owned media group and is currently trying to get approval for it to buy all the Tribune stations. Sinclair owns a huge number of TV stations.
They have 193 stations. They're in 40% of markets of households covered. With the Tribune acquisition, they would be in 71% of the country.
And what's happening is that, as happened all along, is that Sinclair then sends memos to each station saying, you must run this editorial, you must run this story. They've been using Boris Epstein and putting him on all the stations. And they sent a script out and had all their anchors record it, saying,
"Do you have the video?
Let me see. Where is it? Is it in? Is there a link in our show notes?
I'll get up right now
because there's a great video of all of the stations in a montage saying the same thing, and it's essentially parroting the Trump line that major news outlets are creating fake news because they don't like him." And let me see if I now. The way it's worded, it doesn't specifically say that it says. Well, I'll play it for you. This is NPR created this, I guess. Yeah.
No, this is Deadspin. Deadspin did this.
Deadspin. Okay.
Deadspin. They deserve all credit for this. This is brilliantly done. I hope that's the full version.
This is Deadspin's tweet on the subject. Let's see if I can play it. Oh, I always have trouble with video. You know what? I'm going to put this in. Let me put this in Edge. For some reason, Microsoft Edge seems happier with video. I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that I'm on a Windows.
I was going to say, wait a minute.
Why would that be?
Remember when Microsoft was evil?
Yeah. Yeah, they used to be evil. Not anymore. Here you go. Let me put the
voice. And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Here we go.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But
we are concerned about troubling and irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some members of the media
use
their platforms to push their own.
They're all saying. Exactly.
Holy crap.
And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
I feel bad for these people.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Yeah.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Deadspin became aware of this when some of these anchors anonymously said, we have to do this.
Well, yeah, because it turns out their contracts, I saw a story today that a journalist paid $40,000
to our democracy.
Would have to pay $25,000 to break the contract.
Oh. So they can't even just quit. They can't walk out the door and say, I'm not going to say that. So they actually literally have to do this.
Strong-armed. Yep.
Well,
and
there you go.
So you're not going to see anybody put words in Marty Baron's mouth.
No.
These poor schmucks.
No.
And by the way, for the folks out there, you probably don't know whether your station is Sinclair or not, you know, because you go by the brand of ABC, NBC, CBS,
Fox.
Well,
that's the other thing. They still run network programming. It's these local
news. Yeah, they still use
news.
That brand for their local news.
Right.
But Sinclair owns them, and Sinclair puts Boris Epstein and that kind of stuff in there.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. They are the ones, of course, that had a special deal with the Trump campaign during the campaign to get access to Trump in return for positive coverage, basically.
Yep.
Let's see. Wendy, more breaches. Panera Bread. Here's one.
What?
This one's a good one. I'm sure, Jeff, you have from time to time gone to Panera Bread online.
I do indeed.
Ordered a sandwich. And then you go and you pick it up. Well, it turns out about 7 months ago, a security researcher noticed that the website was leaking this information. They had sequential customer numbers, and all you'd have to do is enter the next number and the next number and the next number and the next number. So he sent a notice to them August 2nd, 2017, saying, hey, you know, you can do this. They dismissed him as a likely scam.
Uh-oh.
A week later, though, they responded and said, oh, thanks for the information. We're working on a resolution. Fast forward to last week, he still was able to exfiltrate all that information in exactly the same way. 8 months later, he finally wrote a note to Brian Krebs and said, hey, you really ought to know about this. Brian published the story, and shortly after he had spoken to Panera's chief information officer, the website was taken down. 8 months later. Now, you didn't get credit card information. You only got the last four of the credit cards, but you would get a user's name, address, phone number, last four of their credit card.
Yeah, it's actually,
number.
I've used the terminals in the place, and it's not very secure at all.
Loyalty number.
Yeah. But you know, here's the scariest leak. The underwear company leaked.
Wait a minute. Which underwear company?
Jesus, when your underwear is not secure.
And then Lord and Taylor in Saks Fifth Avenue. You're talking about MyFitnessPal. Yeah.
Under Armour.
Yeah, MyFitnessPal. 150 million accounts. But Wendy, these are most of the time not including credit card numbers. They may include passwords. In the case of MyFitnessPal, they reset the passwords, required everybody to re-log in. What's the risk? What's the danger of all of these leaks?
I think the largest danger of these sorts of information leaks in general is twofold. If there's information about the users, they can either be used and automated in account takeover attacks on other sites, or the information, and this is something that I saw when I was working for the Retail Intelligence Sharing and Analysis Center, is that criminals can take the information about users and turn that into a scam against each user. In other words, they can contact the user and pretend to be the retailer and say and sort of authenticate themselves by saying, we, you know, have this information on you. We, you know, your order number 45678, you know, on this date, and get them to give up even more information in response. So that's another danger, that criminals can authenticate themselves as a retailer by using information that a customer would only expect that retailer to have.
That's a really good point. They're much more credible in phishing scams as a result. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Wendy, is your job depressing?
It not anymore, now that I work where I do, because I think, you know, our company has a very optimistic look on being able to make security better. But certainly, you know, I spend a lot of time talking with chief information security officers, and they can turn into therapy sessions where, you know, that they're telling me about what they're doing. And I'm like, I know, I'm not surprised by any of this. It is very, very hard. Especially in areas like retail where the margins are so slim, they often don't necessarily get the budget that they need to address this properly.
Today's leak of the day. Thank you, Scooter X, in our chat room.
I want to just do something back earlier.
Wait a minute. I haven't given you the leak of the day. Hold on. Delta Airlines.
I thought that was leak of the day.
No. I'm not even done. There's Lord & Taylor, Saks Fifth Avenue, the leak of the day. Yeah. Delta says online chat cybersecurity breach put some customer payment info at breach. That's a big one. Payment info. That's a little more serious.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I just wanted to, earlier story we hit on, I just saw a tweet from Patrick Ruffini, who's a conservative consultant, reacting to the Facebook reading Messenger.
Yeah.
Ruffini says on Ezra Klein's podcast, Zuckerberg said the ability to do this is what stopped messages from going out that incited further ethnic violence in Myanmar. Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
No, and they got a lot of heat for Myanmar.
Yeah, so go, and where the stuff is happening now is in private messaging.
Yeah.
And what do we expect?
Well, I just need to tell people, if you use Messenger, we will be scanning your messages for content that violates our terms of service. If you don't, then there's a problem. They need, it's all about disclosure. If people clearly understood what was going on and then still use the Messenger, I wouldn't have a problem with it. They need to disclose. Do you not agree, Jeff?
Yeah, but this is the irony of some of this is that, and Wendy, jump in here, at a security level, you could argue that the more transparent you are about it, the less likely you are to then catch the bad guys.
That's not their job to create a honeypot for racial cleansing in Myanmar. Their job is not to create a honeypot. Their job is to tell users what they're getting involved.
Oh, but I'm hearing, oh boy, do I hear a lot right now about how, yes, their job is to recognize the responsibility of their role of how it's being used in Myanmar.
Well, that's true, but not be a honeypot, not hide that we're going to look at it so we can catch you. That's not their role. That's not at all their role.
Well, but there's a question of how transparent are you. I agree with you on this one. I agree with you. But it has nuance.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
And we're going to leave it at that.
That's the greatest discussion ender there is, you know?
Can I has nuance?
Nuance, man. Nuance.
Yes, I can has nuance.
I can has nuance?
Oh, no. I've got a nuance headache. No.
And the answer is maybe.
Maybe. I use Duo. I love Duo, yeah. Wendy. I want to thank you for being here. Duo, I don't know all of your businesses, but the two-factor authentication that Duo does, I use with LastPass. Instead of a number, it sends you a notification which you can agree to, which is, to me, not only the easiest way, but it's a more secure way to offer second factor. And actually, we are now looking at putting Duo into our office and requiring that everybody who has access to our password vault and LastPass use Duo as well, because we have a lot of people who have a password which they set to our enterprise LastPass. But I would like them to have two-factor on that as well and require that. And I think Duo is
very important, especially for LastPass.
Yeah, there's just too much
or any password manager. Yeah.
It's great to have you, Wendy. Thank you so much for joining us. Wendy runs the advisory CISO group at Duo Security. She's director there, and she's at Wendy Nather on the Twitter. So nice to talk to you in Austin and have you back
Thank
on
you
the show
for
today.
Having me.
Thank you. Jeff Jarvis is an SOB who works at the City University of New York.
Professor SOB to you.
Professor SOB. I know there is no doubt, but I love Jeff and Jeff loves me. We're good friends, and that's why we argue, right? Yeah. BuzzMachine.com.
That's exactly why, because we know we can.
Yeah, we love each other. So thank you, Jeff, for being here as always. Are you traveling in the near future, or are you going to stay home for a little bit?
Yeah, next week is in Perugia, Italy.
Oh, you son of a... Now I'm just jealous.
All in life.
Now I'm just
2 days.
Jealous.
I have to rush back, so I'm there for 2 days.
Well,
two dinners of pasta.
It's a mixed thing because he gets to go to Italy next week, but tomorrow he has to spend time with the post office. So, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Comes and goes.
I got some of the fun trade off.
We love Ant Pruitt. It's great to have you on this show. We're going to have you on more often on this. He's a contributor to Tech Republic. You follow him on Twitter at _Pruitt, PRUITT. And where can people see your I guess Instagram is a good way to follow you, right?
Yes, sir. Follow me on Instagram. There's no underscore there. It's just Ant Pruitt. But I'd appreciate it if everyone would subscribe to my YouTube channel as well, because I'm doing a few more tutorials.
That's great.
Republic has asked me to do a few more tutorials as well. It's just youtube.com/AntPruitt. Do we have a moment so I can ask Miss Wendy a question?
Yes.
Yeah, Miss Wendy, right ahead. And
now I know Mr. Jarvis was asking if you're depressed when you meant to deal with your clients and whatnot.
Because I'm an SOB.
But it also made me think about a shameless plug, a video session that I did with Mr. Dan Patterson, where I wrote about IT users are like the worst when it comes to security inside of the enterprise. Have you found that?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that it's more that we don't build things in a very usable way in general. Now, we're trying to improve on that. Certainly, you know, at Duo, we actually have people coming up to us saying, oh, I love Duo. And when do you ever say that about a security product?
I always say I do love Duo, actually. Right.
But it's that we don't understand our users' needs and their imperatives very well. And if we can design things better so as not to get in their way, then they're perfectly happy with it. So I think, you know, everybody has friction that they have to deal with technology. I get cranky as hell whenever any SaaS application that I use makes a gratuitous UI change. They move something from one side of the screen to the other, in the middle of my session. I get really cranky about that. So, you know, we just have to get a lot better about not assuming that people are just as happy and can overlook some of the things that we overlook.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of
they're lazy. They have post-it notes on the side of their screen with their passwords.
Well, that, and then you have, it's just that whole God complex. I'm an IT, I can do whatever I want kind of thing. You know, at the previous company that I worked for, I ran into a lot of that with the upper tier IT folks. And I'm like, dude, you know that's a security risk. Just slow your roll.
You know, there's a scene in Ready Player One, and it's actually a lot of the movie turns on the fact that the bad guy has his password on a post-it note in his VR chair. He can't remember it, so he's in his...
Yeah, that's now become a trope, and you know, that's emblematic of... It's the bad design. You know, whoever thought that storing primary authentication in you know, fragile human memory was a good idea.
Crazy.
It was widespread and it was cheap at the time. But, you know, that was our bad designing that and then telling them not to write it down. But I agree that in some cases there are, you know, IT people who, you know, still have the attitude of, you know, I control all of this and I'm, you know, I'm going to make you do what I want. But the other thing is, We tend to moralize a lot around technology and, you know, say that users are lazy or, you know, they're ignorant. when it's really we who have failed them. And that attitude is starting to get better. It used to be, you know, the users were just called losers and they were called stupid.
Stupid users.
Exactly. And luckily that's going away because, you know, at some point the users are going to rise up and say, how exactly is this our fault?
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll have a good answer for them.
Go see Ready Player One and look look for the post-it note. And then I want to know, Wendy, if he had a good password or a bad password. It looked good, but it was
so typical.
It was typical. Did you think that? Are you sitting in the movie thinking, "Oh, that's so typical"?
Seriously. Yeah, I mean, it was Boss Man, you know, with fives for S.
Oh, it was. God!
Yeah, I looked at it. I examined that password very, very thoroughly. But yeah, it was like Boss Man. Actually, it was Boss Man 69, if I remember
Elite.
Correctly.
So, oh my God! I didn't notice it.
It was so juvenile. So yes, that was part of the trope itself.
Here's Ant's Instagram, but don't forget his YouTube account, which is youtube.com/AntPruitt. Thank you all for being here. Really
Thank
a fun
you,
show
Thank
today.
You.
I really.
May I leave you with this? I just saw Mike Godwin, creator of Godwin's Law. I just saw.
Yes.
He has a new law.
Yes.
He didn't call it a law, but we call it a law. It is this. The difficulty with high dudgeon is that the clarity of the analysis is inversely proportional to the height of the dudgeon.
Oh, I like
Are
that.
Are you accusing me of high dudgeon?
I said nothing. I just so tweeted you.
That's his new phrase. Forget moral panic. We got high dudgeon.
High dudgeon. Yeah,
high dudgeon
that
here.
That you know, the dudgeon's getting up there. Dudgeon's getting higher.
Dudgeon's getting higher, man. Dudgeon's got a dudge.
Yeah.
Thank you all for joining us. We do This Week at Google every Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to stop by and watch live, go to twit.tv/live. And if you do that, be in the chat room by all means, irc.twit.tv. You can download on-demand audio and video, of course, of everything we do from our website, in this case, twit.tv/twig. We've got every show there, all of our shows. But also, you can subscribe in your favorite podcatcher, whether it's Overcast or Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, whatever you use, subscribe because you don't want to miss an episode. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.